From Maryland to New Mexico, Louisiana to Michigan, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the death of Pope Francis has sparked a retrospective look at his papacy and speculation over who will become the next pontiff. John Gizzi of Newsmax is here with a look at the life and legacy of Pope Francis. A proposal to increase the top income tax rate has been scuttled by President Donald Trump and House Speaker Mike Johnson. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with a real story. The deep state isn't just a problem at the federal level, as one Hawaii homeowner discovered. Eric Bame and Christian Britsky of Reason Magazine are here with details. And Donald Trump's hyperactive first 100 days in office are about to come to an end. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has a look at how his presidency has changed America and the world on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The sudden death of Pope Francis has put a spotlight on the world's most influential religious post. For a review of the Pope's legacy and a look at what lies ahead for the Catholic Church, we turn to John Gizzi. He is Chief White House Correspondent for Newsmax. John, welcome back to American Radio Journal. John, with the passing of Pope Francis, let's begin. You have observed the Vatican for a number of decades, a number of papacies. I would be interested in your reflections on Pope Francis, his life and legacy.
Like all figures of consequence, and he certainly was that, Pope Francis was a figure in conflict. His profile, his legacy will be one of compassion. He was always reaching out to the downtrodden, to the people that some felt the Catholic Church had forgotten about. He washed the feet of the poor in public. He met with anyone. He held children in his arms. He certainly, almost famously, reached out to the LGBTQ community and sided with illegal immigrants, a contrast, I might add, to the public stands of his two immediate predecessors. One can debate the merits of this or not, but it was entirely a different style of leadership from a different kind of pope. Remember, he was the first pope from the Western Hemisphere, or as the Europeans put it, from the other end of the world. He had been a barroom bouncer, a janitor. He had a girlfriend, something he loved to delight biographers by reminiscing about, and became a priest at the age of 33 and moved on from there. But in other words, he was not grounded in the studies of theology and history like the other recent popes have been. Now, he was also someone who grew up under the aegis of Juan and Evita Perón in Argentina. Socialism, animosity toward the rich, a passion for the poor. This is how the man came to adulthood. I might add that he was already a pastor when Juan Perón returned to Argentina after 17 years of exile back in 1973, and 1 million people turned out at the airport. His contempt for profit, his unkind comments about business, and his idea that this had to change before we solved any problems were not exactly in the Catholic tradition. His predecessor, Pope Leo XIII, wrote a famous document, Rerum Novarum, about labor and business being equal and a part of God's plan. Francis saw it differently. This led to a conflict with a lot of people who believed markets were the answer, notably Javier Milei, president of Argentina, a committed disciple of the Austrian economists and libertarian. He said that the Pope was the Antichrist and the devil's representative on earth. Well, when he became president, he went to see the Pope from Argentina, the Pope from the Pampas. They patched things up. Pelé hugged him, and the Pope said, noting his famous tousled hair, "Did you get a haircut for me?" And in the end, it worked out. President Pelé is going to his funeral. Overall, the legacy will be one of a kindly face for the Catholic Church, but someone with whom, when one had disagreements, he did not take it very well, and he went off on his own agenda in his own direction.
And now we have to turn the page, John, and the process of selecting a new pope is steeped in ancient history and very interesting. So tell us a bit about what's going to occur now. We have the funeral for Pope Francis this weekend, and then very soon thereafter are going to move to conclave. Tell us a bit about that.
The conclave, as people who've seen the movie know, is the actual election of the spiritual leader of 1.4 billion Catholics worldwide. The cardinals, the princes of the church, will gather in Rome to mourn Pope Francis. He'll be arriving Saturday. All cardinals under the age of 80 are eligible to vote for Pope. There are 136 cardinals who are going to be, let's say, the electoral college for the Pope. On either March 6th or March 12th, the date has not yet been determined, they will gather at the Sistine Chapel. The doors will be locked. They will have no cell phones, no recording devices, and they will take an oath before God to keep all the proceedings secret. From there, after morning prayer and breakfast, they ballot twice, break for lunch, ballot again. Once a candidate for Pope gets two-thirds of the vote, he is elected. Now, this can go on for 33 ballots, and at that point, they have a runoff for Pope between the top two vote-getters. That's never had to occur. In fact, if you go back 100 years, it has taken 4 days or less to choose any of the popes who have sat on the throne of St. Peter. And, of course, how many of us have not seen the famous scene in which the Carmelengo, who presides over the election of the Pope, will come out on the balcony at the chapel and announce, "Habemus Papa," we have a Pope. The Pope has already chosen a name, this Pope choosing Francis after St. Francis of Assisi because of his commitment to help the poor. And then their reign progresses, and what follows is a coronation, parade, and celebration worthy of a monarch. As for the election of a pope, it is difficult to say. I'm certainly not going to predict any winners, part of it out of respect to the late pope who's being mourned, but also because it's very, very hard to determine what 136 old men voting in secret are going to do. More often than not, the election of the Pope is a surprise, and those who thought they knew all about it were shown not to. As the saying goes at the Vatican, he who goes in the conclave a Pope comes out a cardinal.
Well, we are certainly going to witness quite a funeral service, quite a mourning period, and then, of course, the spectacle of a new pope taking to that balcony at the end of all of this. We have been talking with John Gizzi. John is the chief White House correspondent and columnist for Newsmax. We can see you, John, on Newsmax TV and read all of your columns, which come out several times a week. Where can we find all that?
I was hoping you'd ask. www.newsmax.com.
John Gizzi, Chief White House Correspondent for Newsmax. John, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Always a pleasure to be here, Lowman. Cheers.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, fresh off the Easter egg roll, but we're going to talk about some activities on the White House lawns and also major political developments. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Lowman. Thank you.
So you were on the South Lawn for the Easter egg roll. I gather you weren't dressed as the Easter Bunny.
Not the bunny this year, but, you know, it's the annual tradition of the White House to invite the public through a lottery and receiving tickets And they have, you know, usually several sessions. I think there's five or six sessions where folks can, you know, stroll around the White House, color eggs. You can, there was some drawing. I think everybody might have seen the video of President Trump sitting down with some kids and crayons. And, you know, he interacted with the media as well and was taking questions related to what's going on over at the Pentagon with Pete Hegseth. And they also have story time, which is kind of cool for the kids. My kids got to listen to the Attorney General Pam Bondi read a story, and I know Caroline Leavitt and others read stories as well. And so, yeah, it's a pretty fun thing. I think a lot of people remember last year, you know, we had Trans Day of Visibility, and a lot changes in a year, depending on what day Easter falls on as well. But later in the week, on Wednesday, President Trump was strolling around the North Lawn, and he made a big announcement that he was going to pay out of his own pocket to place a 100-foot flagpole on the North Lawn. And, you know, some people say, well, there's, you know, an American flag on top of the White House already. Why do we need a big one on the North Lawn as well? Well, you know, most government buildings actually have flagpoles in front of their building and flags on top of their buildings as well. I think this is a kind of a cool thing, and it's especially cool because it's not going to cost the taxpayers anything. Trump's going to handle it himself.
Well, a lot of developments on the White House lawn. Meanwhile, there was another major development. Of course, we have Congress moving toward this reconciliation bill. There's been some ideas floated of raising the top marginal tax rate. It seems that that's going down in flames.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago, Club for Growth put out a statement saying that it was a red line for the club in supporting the overall reconciliation package, which will include the extension and expansion of the Trump 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And, you know, there was a rumor that was persistent, but never actually attributed to anybody directly, that the White House was interested in increasing the top rate from 37% to 40% or even higher. And, you know, this would be devastating in a lot of different ways. I think especially politically, if Republicans were behind a big tax rate increase. And the good news is that this week, Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, and President Trump came together and said, no, this is not happening. It's not on the table. We're not going to increase the top rate. And the good news now is that we can really focus on pro-growth policies that can be included in the reconciliation package and really get this economy going again. So, you know, the Club for Growth will be advocating for what's known as neutral cost recovery. It allows for the full and immediate expensing of capital expenditures, including structures. So you might remember from the 2017 law, we had a version of expensing, and unfortunately it phased out and expired, and it didn't actually provide for the certainty that businesses need in order to make long-term decisions to expand and reinvest. Instead, it was sort of like a sugar rush where there was a good bump of growth after the taxes were passed, the tax cuts were passed. However, we want to make sure that there is certainty in the code. And that's one of the big things that the Senate is working on, making sure that this round of tax cuts is permanent. And, you know, you can have permanency for some policies and expiration for others. And I think for the pro-growth, pro-business tax cuts, we need to have certainty and permanency and neutral cost recovery. The ability to write off expenses for new structures and manufacturing is a big, big goal of ours. It will help significantly when it comes to the domestic production of a lot of these things that Trump wants to reshore.
Meanwhile, we have a major political development this past week. Dick Durbin, the U.S. Senator from Illinois, announcing his retirement. Illinois, not exactly a competitive state, but serious repercussions from this will ensue. Why is that?
Well, let's remember, back in 2010, there was a congressman named Mark Kirk, Republican, more of a moderate, but he won in the Tea Party wave in Illinois. One Democrat congresswoman that I think will probably end up getting in the race is Lauren Underwood,
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
We are united in the idea of economic freedom, liberty, opportunity, and you can actually visit us at clubforgrowth.org, sign up and become a member for free, and also visit us on X at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
A Hawaii homeowner took a trip through building permit purgatory, and it was epic. We get details now from Eric Boehm and Christian Britsky of Reason Magazine.
Imagine buying a house that's nearly 40 years old, living in it for 5 years, and then discovering that your county government considers the home to be illegal. It should never have been built in the first place. That's the real-life nightmare that one Hawaiian man is living through, and that is the story we're going to take a look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Christian Britschke. He's a colleague of mine at Reason Magazine, an editor of the magazine, and also the author of our weekly housing policy newsletter. Rent Free is the name of that newsletter. You can sign up for it right there at reason.com. Get it in your inbox every week. Christian joins us now to talk about this story that he covered in that newsletter last week. Christian, thanks for joining us, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Tell me what happened with Shahzad Ousman. He bought a seaside house in Hawaii that had been there for 40 years and then discovered the house was somehow illegal?
Yes. So Shahzad Ousman, he purchased a house in 2021 on the Big Island in Hawaii. And, you know, the house, it's a small beach house that was undergoing renovations when he purchased it. As part of the purchase process, he checked with the county, his broker, his appraiser, all checked with the county to make sure that the remodeling permit was good and that he was, you know, there weren't any permitting issues with the house. He suddenly sees that his permit is supposed to expire before he was told it was supposed to expire. And so he calls the county and says, hey, what's up here? And they at first say, oh, no, you don't have anything to worry about. Continue with your work. After he finishes some work, he can't get an inspector to come out. So he calls again. And this is when the county informs him that, oh, no, actually your permit is canceled. But it's not the remodeling permit, which had been issued in 2020. It was actually the permit that had been issued for the entire house back in 1987. And so this meant that he wasn't allowed to occupy the house, that any continued, that he would have to stop the work he was doing on the house and, in fact, dismantle some of the work that had already been done and completely reapply for permits from scratch.
And as you point out in the piece, he'd already spent something like $138,000 on remodeling work. I mean, that's a ton of money. But the bigger question, I guess, is like, what is he supposed to do now? Build a time machine and go back and fix that permitting issue from what, 40 years ago? Or bulldoze the house and start over? What's he got to do here?
Right. So this is what's what makes it even more complicated from his situation is, yeah, as you mentioned, he'd already spent a significant amount of money remodeling the house. Because the house is unpermitted, so you have to get a completely new permit. But the problem is when the house was built, it was built closer to the shoreline than current regulations allow. And so he would have to move the house in order to get a special state permit that you'd need in order to build close to the shoreline. But in order to move the house, then he'd be dismantling and basically rebuilding it, and he would have to build to the new code, which would basically mean completely bulldozing the house and starting over. And so, you know, he wasn't willing to do this given the huge amount of money he'd already spent on it, the fact that people had been living in the house for decades with no apparent problem. And so in response, he sued the county to try and get his permits reinstated.
And how's that going? This is relatively new. I guess there hasn't been a ruling or anything like that yet.
No. So yes, he did. So he won. So he lost an administrative hearing where basically he goes to before a county board to try to argue that the county was wrong. And the county sided with the county. But then he sues in a state court or a local district court, and he wins that lawsuit. But there's still the county can still appeal. And while they still have the option to appeal, they're still telling him he can't live in the house and that he'll be fined if he tries to enter the house. And this is after a court has already said, yes, your permit is good. The county is completely in the wrong. Go ahead. Like, you're allowed to keep building and working on this house and living in this house.
I know you just sort of deadpanned it there, but I want to emphasize the fact that, like, the county sided with the county. That's the way this process starts, is with these administrative hearings. You know, that's really a separate issue. We're not going to get into it here, but I mean, these administrative courts, administrative hearings that go on at the county level, at the state level, at the federal level, like, it's just so difficult sometimes to challenge regulations when they, you know, when they go against you as a homeowner, a property owner, a business owner, any of that.
Yeah, actually, to take a point on that, yeah, it was kind of remarkable reading the transcript of the county hearing that they had, where the county lawyer was, you know, ripping into Shahzad for his, like, you know, you didn't do your due diligence by simply relying on what the county told you about whether your house was legal. You should have done this other thing. You know, you should have gone back and looked at old real estate listings or something like that. You know, the county's word wasn't good enough.
It's just completely ridiculous. This is a one-off story in some sense, because it's, you know, this situation with this guy, but there's something like 40,000 permits that actually could be at stake. This is a much bigger issue. This says something about the way in which we regulate housing in this country and a lot of different states. And this contributes to the housing crisis, doesn't it?
Right. There's a lot of other homeowners who could potentially be in Shahzad's position. And then secondly, yeah, Hawaii is probably the most heavily regulated state when it comes to land use, and probably has some of the most heavily regulated land use in the world. I know we talked previously about the very slow process of rebuilding in Maui, and it's after the wildfires there. And, you know, it's for similar reasons like this. You know, something happens, a home burns down, and then you have to comply with not just a very robust set of land use regulations, but also rules that have gotten much tighter since your home was built, and so, or your business was built. And so maybe the thing that burned down is not something that can be rebuilt today legally. So it's something that affects a lot of people.
Yeah, we're seeing that in Maui. You've reported on that. Obviously, you've also covered in California some of the same issues with regulations there. And I mean, this is an issue that goes on really everywhere. I think it's terrific to highlight these specific kind of really ridiculous cases, because they do, I think they emphasize, they really show how just difficult it is to build housing in this country. And that has all sorts of ramifications. Folks, if you want to read more about this, check out Christian's newsletter, Free Rent. You can sign up for that at reason.com and get it in your inbox every week. Christian, thanks for joining us, man. Really great conversation.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
And once again, that is Christian Britschke. He is the author of Reason's weekly housing policy newsletter, Rent Free. You can get that at reason.com. Sign up for it there and get it in your inbox every week. We got a bunch of other newsletters, so check those out as well. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bam. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Donald Trump will complete the first 100 days of his second term this week. It has been one of the most impactful starts to a presidential term in U.S. history, as we learn from Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Next Tuesday or Wednesday will be Donald Trump's 100th day in office in his second term, depending on how you count the first day. You can expect a lot of news coverage, and most of that coverage will be biased. I'm going to give you a key you can listen for in that coverage that will tell you just how biased a given story is. But first, a little history. The significance of a president's first 100 days was established by President Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1933 to highlight his aggressive set of actions to turn around the bad economy he had inherited from his predecessor, Herbert Hoover. A quick start like FDR's or Trump's is traditionally possible only when one party has control of the presidency and both houses of Congress, sometimes referred to as a trifecta. Until the second Trump term, presidents enjoying a trifecta produced legislation on a fast track. But Donald Trump has upended that idea by his extensive use of executive orders, while actually signing fewer bills into law than any recent president. This has prompted many on the left to claim a constitutional crisis. So now let's take a look at a few of the mainstream media opinion pieces whose anti-Trump bias is so great that they seem anti-patriotic. First, the New York Times, under a headline that says, "Why Trump's 100-day blitz may lead to a historic bust," and it elaborates as follows, quote, It is safe to say that the first 100 days of Donald Trump's second presidency will be considered the most consequential of any in modern history. Since taking office, Mr. Trump has consolidated extraordinary power in the executive branch, dismantled large portions of the federal government, undone the military and economic alliances that were formed following World War II, and torn up the policy consensus that has governed global trade for just as long. But a consequential start does not in any way equate to long-term success. Mr. Trump's approval ratings are already falling, and if past presidencies are any guide, the worst is yet to come. Close quote. Doesn't that sound almost giddy with delight that Trump is failing? Nowhere does the Post acknowledge that the Trump first 100 days are filled with actions that he had promised to take when a candidate. And that's what I want to suggest that you use as a quick bias indicator. If a given story on Trump's first 100 days fails to mention that most of his actions are exactly what he said he would do as a candidate, then that story is intrinsically biased. Of course, that doesn't mean that a story that does cite his campaign promises is not biased, only that it isn't as heavily biased as one that never acknowledges his pledges. Now, let's take a look at the Washington Post, where Dana Milbank's column is titled, Trump's 100-Day Blitz May Lead to a Historic Bust. Here are some of Milbank's claims, slightly edited for length. Quote, by any reasonable measure, President Donald Trump's first 100 days will be judged an epic failure. He has been a legislative failure. He has signed only 5 bills into law, the worst performance at the start of a new president's term in more than a century. He has been an economic failure. On his watch, growth has slowed, consumer and business confidence has cratered, and markets have plunged. He has been a foreign policy failure. He said he would end wars in Gaza and Ukraine, but fighting has resumed in Gaza after the demise of the ceasefire negotiated by his predecessor, and Russia continues to brutalize Ukraine. He has been a failure in the eyes of friends, having launched a trade war against Canada, Mexico, Europe, and Japan, enraged Canada with talk of annexation, threatened Greenland and Panama, and cleaved the NATO alliance. He has been a failure in the eyes of foes, as it emboldened China, menaces Taiwan, and punches back hard in the trade war. He has been a constitutional failure. He has been a failure in public opinion, unquote, and so on. What's missing? Not one word about his successes with stemming the tide of illegal immigration, one of the deciding issues of his presidential campaign, and no acknowledgement that the tariffs are exactly what Trump promised as a means of addressing decades-long trade imbalances and unfairness. So, as we all await a flood of critical coverage, my advice to the listeners of American Radio Journal is simple. Listen for some concession that the president's actions are fulfillments of the very pledges that got him elected, which is to say, what the American electorate said they wanted. That's what a president is supposed to do. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WYAY-FM in Wilmington, North Carolina, WPGI-FM in Charleston, South Carolina, along with WZFC-AM in Winchester, Virginia. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.